You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
So we'll start off on the Red Planet this time, or actually not yet on the Red Planet, with a mission that's going to go to the Red Planet. The mission that, as we mentioned a few months ago, has now been named the Rosalind Franklin Rover, the ExoMars Rover, part of the ExoMars mission from the European Space Agency. It's being built in Stevenage, no less, so here in the UK, and they've put a draw in.
Yes, it seems like something that you do on a weekend when you've been to your favourite flat pack DIY shop. But this is quite an advanced draw. It's a laboratory, all-in-one draw, and it's going to do what a lot of rovers and a lot of missions to Mars have not failed to do, but have sort of laid the groundwork for. Many missions have looked at the habitability of Mars. This one is actually looking for whether Mars was inhabited. It's looking for biomarkers. It's called the Analytical Laboratory Draw, and which is a rather strange name, and it's going to be one of the bits of equipment on the Rosalind Franklin rover as part of the ExoMars mission. And it's going to smash up bits of Mars and analyse these bits of Mars, looking for biomarkers, particularly looking for amino acids and sugars, and looking for things like whether they're right-handed or left-handed, and that means whether the arrangement of the atoms, whether the hydroxide bit is on the left or the right. And that means that that makes it possible for these two compounds to react together and be useful for life.
We think here on Earth, a right-handed and left-handed, doesn't life only use one of them? Is that right? Or do you need a right...
Amino acids uses left-handed, I think, and right. Sugars uses right-handed.
Right, okay, so, and that means
that they can work right together. And the other part is looking for ancient microfossils as well, which obviously... You're looking at pictures of things in that. You can't really do a chemical analysis of something because, after all, after petrification has happened, it is actually rock.
Yeah,
you're not going to find bone. It is rock. But you can look at pictures and convince yourself that maybe you find microfossils that are very, very ancient.
And these will be tiny as well. So the it turned out to not be the case, but there was a story in... the late 90s, early 90s, about the meteorite.
Yes, the Martian meteorite.
Maybe some evidence of worms in, which turned out to have been geological formations, like little bits of rock. But that we're looking for that kind of thing with this. Right? We're not looking for dinosaur bones.
No.
Like nothing massive.
No,
tiny things.
Not Martian dinosaurs this time, but very small things, the evidence of very small life.
Yeah. And the analysis is difficult because when the Viking probes went in the 70s, they landed and they tried to heat stuff up. But one of the problems there is that the heating the material up releases some particular chemicals. They're called perchlorates, which are a type of salty substance. And they completely swamp all the measurements you might make. So later missions have been studying to try and find out how to analyze the samples without damaging the measurements, without swamping the measurements with the byproducts, if you like. So this is another step in trying to do this. And also looking much, much, much deeper down under Mars. So the samples that this collects are not going to be from a scoop on the rover or from something drilling down a couple of inches, which is what the Curiosity rover does. This is going to be drilling down a couple of metres, which is thought to be a key area on Mars because of the protection you get from cosmic rays a couple of metres down.
Yeah, that's right, because cosmic rays will, of course, irradiate things that are close to the surface. Also, they're going to target sites where there is known water because, obviously, as well as these biomarkers, part of the habitability is whether you have water, the presence of water. And as we know, life that we know on Earth needs water in the main to survive. And so that's why the sites that they're going to choose for doing this analysis are going to be sites that are known to have had water.
So the site it's going to is Oxia Planum. It's due for launch in 2020 and it'll get to Mars in 2021. So a few years of waiting, a bit more building in Stevenage, no doubt, and then it'll be assembled into the rocket for launch in a couple of years. Or in a year, next year. 2020 is next year. Wow, that's gone quickly. Okay, so moving closer to Earth, and instead of going to objects, sometimes the objects come to us, luckily not too close, because this is an object we really don't want to hit us. Now, we're recording this before the closest approach of this object, but you'll be listening to this after the closest approach. It's an object that goes by the name of 1999 KW4. Should we stick to KW4 for ease? So discovered in 1999, hence the name. This is something called a near-Earth asteroid, near-Earth object, and we don't really want this to hit the Earth.
No, it's about a mile wide, and that's quite big. Yeah. If that were to hit the Earth, that would cause substantial damage, as you can imagine. A mile-wide thing sitting, approaching very, very quickly would basically destroy most of life on Earth, or certainly in the hemisphere that it hit.
But this one won't.
This one won't. This one's going to pass about 13 Earth-Moon distances away from us. So there's really no chance that this is going to hit. We've known about it obviously since 1999, but we've only just been able to get observations of it as it's going to pass close to us because it was behind the sun, and the glare of the sun has stopped us from doing analysis. So it's approaching us very, very fast. It's got a very elongated orbit, so it's not got a circular orbit like the or mostly circular orbit like the planets going around the sun. It's got a very elongated egg-shaped orbit, so it's approaching the Earth very fast. It's going to then come in, swing past us, and then head out. And that's actually when we're going to be able to get the best observations, best pictures of it, so that we can analyse it. But it's very interesting because this, as well as being a mile wide asteroid, it has a friend. It has a smaller asteroid that's going around it, like a little asteroid moon, which is about a third of the size. It's quite interesting. Something that big passing so close won't happen again for another 8 or 9 years. Mm. So it's, I think, 2027.
So
it's really a really good opportunity for us to study a strange object like this with this two component. And we've seen that it has this moon from radar images.
So the radar measurements give us an idea of how fast this is spinning, and as you say, the fact that it's got this moon going round us, but it will be direct images of the optical telescopes, such as with your own Las Cabras Observatory, which will be important for knowing more about this. So what kind of things are we hoping to learn as it flies away from us, when it's moving a little bit more slowly, and so it's easier to take pictures of?
So we're hoping to learn more about the two objects, so we can measure the brightness. And as it's going away and it's not so bright, we'll be able to take detailed measurements of how the brightness changes, and we won't be able to resolve the two images, the two objects. We won't be able to see them as two separate things, and that'll give us a good idea of the orbital period of the moon. And that's something that the listeners can be involved with. If you go to asteroidtracker.lco.global. You'll be able to take your own observations of this object and contribute to the science that we're doing.
Excellent. So anyone can get involved in taking this. How long is that going on for, Asteroid Tracker?
We're going to be doing that for a couple of weeks.
Okay. So it'll be there for till mid-June, I guess. Okay, so this is an asteroid. It goes from between the orbits of the Earth and closer than Mercury, and it has this moon. We know of a number of asteroids that have got moons, they've got smaller objects around them, and we know of a number of objects much further out in the solar system that have got moons as well. One recent example of this was the object that the New Horizons spacecraft flew past at the start of the year. This was the object called 2014 MU69, MU69 to its friends. This was a bizarre object because when, as New Horizons got closer, it was shown to actually really be two objects, but instead of one going around the other, these are attached. It's a snowman. It looks like a snowman.
A very strange snowman, yeah. Because one of them's like a disc almost, and the other one's more like a squished snowball. That's very odd, actually. We've seen very few objects that are rocky that are flat. Mm-hmm. They tend to be potato shaped, so it's very knobbly, spherical or cigar shaped, and those are all either because they're small, so they can't pull themselves into what they want to be, which is something that's rounded, or in the scar-shaped ones, it's because they're rotating around the long axis. Mm. And having a flat one is really very interesting. So it must have had some strange interactions.
Well, it implies it was spinning quickly to flatten out into a disc, right?
Yes, that's right. Very, very quickly, because normally if it's just spinning, it will form a ball.
Yeah. And then this presumably happened. The thinking is, because these objects don't show any signs of having been affected by a fast collision, so they haven't crashed together and stuck. They've gently approached each other and stuck together. So it's not clear exactly how that happened. It's also not 100% clear whether they formed separately or whether they formed in the same place and gradually approached. It's hard to imagine how two objects orbiting each other would gradually approach on any sort of sensible time scale. That should take billions of years normally. But if they form separately and just happen to get close together, then they may have sort of touched.
Then they get stuck together.
And then they stuck, yeah. Things happen very slowly out in the Kuiper Belt. I mean, yes. This thing takes 300 years to go around the sun, or nearly 300 years to go around the sun. So it's a long way out, and things happen incredibly slowly. It's all very cold as well. These initial results have just been published. We had a bit that was coming out as in the sort of the news releases when it first flew by, but the data is still being downloaded until sort of the middle of next year. So there's still presumably lots more to come. And New Horizons itself is still trying to look for other objects that it can take pictures of. Nowhere near as close, but to try and take pictures of other objects it might fly past out in the Kuiper Belt as well. So lots more to come from New Horizons in the future. Speaking of things that are coming in thick and fast, the LIGO and Virgo observatories, these gravitational wave observatories based in the United States and in Europe, and it's an international team which we're heavily involved with here in Cardiff. They started at the start of April this year, their third observing run of the Advanced Detector era, and it's due to go on for about a year. Now, this is an upgrade from last year's detector state, or the previous run's detector situation. They're more sensitive. That means they can see the objects they're finding, which are typically black holes coalescing together, merging together, or possibly neutron stars merging together. And it can see them further out, which means it can see more of them. And in the last, it's about 2 months, there've been over a dozen of these things. So we're seeing that more than one a week on average. Most of them appear to be black holes merging. These are only candidate events. They're still being vetted by the science teams. They're only candidate events for now. But there's a couple of interesting ones that have come up because, Edward, your organisation, Las Cumbres Observatory, and lots of others around the world, are interested in following up objects or taking more observations of objects that might have a flash of light. And that's not black holes, because there's no matter there to produce a flash.
As far as we know.
Well, this is true, yes. But neutron stars. And there's been a couple of hints that maybe there were some neutron stars there.
Yes, that's right. And neutron stars, the very famous result from 2 years ago with the kilonova of the binary neutron stars coalescing, was quite a spectacular, not only physical astronomical phenomenon, but also a demonstration of collaboration between gravitational wave observatories and traditional electromagnetic normal telescopes. And Las Cumbres Observatory were heavily involved in that, as were many others. Everybody is very keen on helping in the effort to identify what these things are, but obviously there's a lot of competition. Everybody wants to be the first to observe these things, and so everybody is subscribing to all of these candidate alerts, and even the ones that are then proved not to be. A colleague of mine was up a mountain and got frantic email alerts saying that there was a new candidate, and had to, by the time he and all his friends had run down the mountain, it was found that the candidate was not actually a real thing.
This is something that happens, right? I mean, the alerts are almost completely automated, so that when detection comes in and it looks like it's significant, then the alert is sent out, because you have to catch these quickly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But the side effect is that there are some false positives.
Yeah. Well, the perfect example was the first kilonova to be discovered. It was only visible above the horizon for something like 30 minutes, and that's everywhere because it was so close to the sun. And so you've got the situation where you have this, if you've got one observatory, you've got, in 24 hour period, you've got 30 minutes to observe it.
Yeah.
And if you miss that 30 minutes, you've got to wait till the next day and everything could have changed by then.
Yeah. So it's people are following up these when they see them. There was an interesting candidate. So there are different types of events. So we can find events that look like there were black holes merging. We can find events that look like there were two neutron stars merging. We can find events that look like they were maybe a neutron star and a black hole merging. The details of what mass they were, that's broken down by what mass the objects looked like they were, is hard to pin down exactly normally. So it's not clear exactly which one they are. But some interesting ones that may have been in something called the mass gap. And this is the gap of masses between about three times the mass of the sun and five times the mass of the sun, where we know of no neutron stars more massive than three solar masses, and we've not seen any black holes less massive than five solar masses. So there appears to be this gap in the mass distribution of objects. And maybe there are hints that possibly one has been seen. More analysis needs to be done to find out whether it was indeed in this mass gap. The chances are it was something else. But that would be fascinating to find an object that doesn't seem to have existed until now. Why that mass gap is there, I don't think is really understood. I think we know why we can't have neutron stars bigger than three solar masses, because they end up forming black holes. But why you can't get black holes less than five solar masses, I'm not too sure. Maybe it's the way stars end their lives or something.
Yeah, that's right. It's not to do with the black hole, but to do with the star that
forms the black hole.
Yeah.
Or the neutron star. So, an interesting set of observations. So it's been a couple of months. There have been a dozen of these things. The observing run is due to be a year long. So that means we're going to have about six times that. So there's going to be several dozen of these things, maybe 60 of these by the end of the observing run. That's a lot more than the 11 we had before.
Yeah.
So these numbers are really really racking up. You can get involved. There's an iPhone app for gravitational wave alerts, so you can keep up to date and get pinged whenever one of these things goes off. You can look at the alerts that come in that come in online. If you want to see where they are in the sky, I've been putting some sky maps up. If you go to gwcat.cardiffgravity.org/skymaps, you can see some of the sky maps of where these things are and which constellations they're in. Although the constellations bear no relevance to where these things actually are. The constellations are local stars. These things are much, much more distant than anything you can see with the naked eye, of course. Lots going on in 03, observing run 3, and possibly lots more, hopefully lots more to come in the future. Perhaps some more kilonovas and binary neutron stars to be followed.
I'm sure there will be.
Now, May 2019 also marks an anniversary. It marks the anniversary, the 10-year anniversary of, unsurprisingly, May 2009. So where were you on the 14th of May 2009? So, Edward, I guess you were in Cardiff?
I was here in Cardiff, and we were eagerly awaiting the arrival of the late Rodri Morgan to come and witness the live stream from the European Space Agency rocket launch for the Herschel and Planck missions.
I was lucky enough to be in French Guiana to be witnessing the launch, which was good fun. So Herschel and Planck were two missions we were heavily involved with in Cardiff. They were big European missions with involvement from around the world. And it's now a decade on. They both lasted for maybe four or five years until their various bits of coolant ran out, and the spacecraft were both turned off and are now just in orbit around the sun. They're billion euro space junk essentially now. But they did a lot when they were running, and their legacy is their archive of data. I thought I'd go and speak to a few colleagues here in Cardiff about the legacy of particularly the Herschel Space Observatory. We spoke about some of the Planck results and the Hubble constant a few months ago. So I spoke to some colleagues about the legacy of the Herschel Space Observatory and what we're still learning from its archive.
Well, we've learned a great deal about the universe, both near and far. In our own solar system, for example, we've learned a lot more about the small solid bodies, the asteroids, and similar objects orbiting further out from the sun in what's called the Kuiper Belt. This is debris left over from the formation of the solar system, so it's telling us about how our solar system works today and giving us some clues as to how it formed in the past. In our own galaxy, we've learned a huge amount about how stars form from clouds of gas and dust in space. And further out, we've learned when looking at distant galaxies, how they form and evolve. So it's given us a new perspective on the whole universe. So that's one of the great great powers of Herschel, its versatility. And because it was exploring a new part of the electromagnetic spectrum, it had something to say in all areas of astrophysics.
That was Professor Matt Griffin, who led one of the three scientific instruments on board the Herschel Space Observatory. Let's drill in a little deeper. What, for example, have we learned about star formation? Here's Dr. Sarah Reagan.
First and foremost, the context of star formation is so much better understood now. And this is thanks to the survey of the entire galactic plane in the far infrared. And what the galactic plane survey did was give us a full census of all the structures involved in star formation, from the web of molecular cloud structures down to the individual protostars that until now had been obscured by dust to us. For the first time, really, we're able to link from the protostar all the way up to the galaxy as a whole. And we understand those, how they're linked together, much better now. And that way, if we can use the Milky Way as sort of a local laboratory, if you want, if we can understand how a protostar is linked to a star formation region, is linked to the galaxy as a whole, then we can view nearby galaxies in a similar way and understand it in terms of the building blocks that the Milky Way has sort of uncovered for us.
The stars we see today are formed from clouds of gas and dust. And a long-standing question in astronomy has been, when and where did all that dust come from? That's exactly what Professor Haley Gomez researches using Herschel.
It's told us two things, really. So the first thing it's told us that was a huge surprise is that the universe was dustier 5 billion years ago than it is today. Far more dustier than we predicted. And you can think of it a bit like the universe is getting cleaner over time. And the other thing it's told us about cosmic dust is where it's made. We didn't really know before Herschel that you need a huge explosion of a massive star. And that's actually where we now believe most of the dust in the universe that goes on to make rocky planets like the Earth is created.
So how has Herschel allowed us to make all these scientific leaps? Dr. Mattia Negrello explains where it gets its superpower.
One important advantage of Herschel compared to previous instrument and the space telescope is the coverage of the sky. So before the launch of Herschel, we had some information about the existence of this highly star-forming dust-obscure galaxies, but in samples of just a few hundred. With Herschel, we managed to increase that number by 1,000. So Herschel managed to deliver us samples of hundreds of thousands of these galaxies because it could observe more than 1,000 square degrees of the sky. Just to give you an idea, if you put together all the surveys done by previous instruments that observed a similar wavelength, if you put them together, the area of the sky they cover at sub-millimeter wavelengths, you don't even cover an area comparable to the size of the full moon. While instead with Herschel, we cover an area that corresponds to more than 5,000 times the area of the full moon. And that means many more galaxies of this kind we can work with and play with. So this is the important legacy of Herschel. And now we have this gold mine we can go through and study in detail all these individual galaxies to understand how they formed and evolve.
There's still a wealth of data to look through with Herschel, but what we've been able to do is we've been able to pinpoint the sites that we believe dust is being formed, so these massive exploding stars and these galaxies that are full of dust that we didn't see before Herschel. And we've been able to go and use telescopes that are slightly different to Herschel but complementary, provide maybe more detailed view or a slightly different view of the dust and the gas in those systems. And we've gone to look at telescopes like ALMA to provide very clear details of what Herschel kind of gives us hints for. And it's kind of paved the way for creating new telescopes and new missions. So for example, the SPEAKER mission is based very much on what Herschel tells us, and the very far in the future FIRI mission that will be like Herschel but 100 times better clarity in what it can see. So it's kind of not just about the science, but also the next generation of technology.
Hayley Gomez looking towards the future there. That's all this month. My thanks to all the guests, Matt Griffin, Sarah Reagan, Hayley Gomez, Mattia Negrello, and of course, Edward Gomez. Don't forget, you can find past episodes at pythagastro.uk, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. And this month, there's a special bonus edition with a 10-year look back at the Herschel Space Observatory. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.